I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Euphemia Fantetti joins me again. She's just published a new memoir, My Father, Fortune Tellers, and Me. It's a fascinating book that chronicles her coming of age, the daughter of two Southern Italian immigrants. It's an acrimonious marriage that her parents haven't made made all the more difficult because of her mother's schizophrenia. Growing up in a family that is superstitious, relying on tarot or fate or for guidance, complicates life as well as adds wit. The book is a marvelous look at the immigrant experience in Canada, as well as the challenges of children born to those immigrants. And the view onto mental health is at once harrowing as it is empathetic. Euphemia Fantetti is a graduate of SFU's Writers Studio at the University of Guelph. She's an award-winning playwright and former stand-up comic. She was first on the program in 2013 when her debut short story collection, A Recipe for Disaster and Other Unlikely Tales, was published. Visit euphemiafantetti.com for more. And the Twitter handle is at Euphemia Fantetti. This new book is from Mother Tongue Publishing. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Euphemia Fantetti. Ms. Fantetti, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph. Thanks so much for having me back.
Thanks for, it's nice to see you in person this time.
Yes, yes.
I can't believe it's 6 years ago since our book was published.
I know. Neither can I.
Yeah. I remember I asked you 6 years ago if there was any connection, because those were short stories.
Yes.
Any connection to, say, experiences that you had, and mm-hmm. I can't remember what you said then, but after reading this memoir, I did see a couple of scenes
that were familiar.
Yeah, like the police officer coming and visiting you.
Yes.
So I guess everything is fodder, isn't it? Life is.
It really is, yeah. I think, you know, when I teach creative writing to my students, I do this exercise where I get them to take something they've actually experienced, and I ask them to do what if, to change the situation and bring in their imagination. So depending on whether you want to write fiction or you want to write nonfiction, there's certainly, I think, writers are people that are incredibly observant, and they take everything that they observe into that storytelling. So whether it's something they've directly experienced or something they've heard about, yeah, I think there were certainly scenes in Recipe for Disaster that were inspired by real life.
Yeah. The observant part, I mean, I've talked to writers over the years, and that seems to be, you know, I guess, key to the writing process. Does a writer then, from what they've observed, they take that, and is any of that helpful, I guess, for their own lives?
I think so. I think what writing does, and I think what readers do, it slows down the outside world and all the chaos, and it gives you this opportunity to connect with each other in a really intimate way, the writers and the readers. And I think all the observations that you make and the story that you write and the stories that you want to write, they're all about making order from chaos, because life is so unpredictable. And when you're structuring a story, you have to actually have to make it make sense for the reader. And so as a writer, you're kind of always looking for, like, where's the entry point to this story, or where's the beginning, where's what's happening in the middle, what do people really need to know, what do I leave in, or what do I take out, so that you can make something really cohesive and something beautiful for someone to read.
And do you find, because you do share a lot in this memoir, mm-hmm. As I was saying before we started, there's a lot in here that one would view as personal and probably private.
Mm-hmm.
Do you impart that onto the reader because you think they could find some use from it?
You know, I think initially my inspiration was wanting to read this story. Like, I'd spent my whole life growing up never reading a story about anyone like my father or anyone like my mother or anyone like me. And that becomes a type of erasure, to never see yourself in literature when you're always reading.
Yeah.
And so initially it was, for me, I thought, I really want to be able to tell this story, and I'd been trying to tell it for years. And then, you know, the hope is that readers get something out of it, that mm-hmm. the very specific aspect of our story of Southern Italians, immigrants, the superstition, the lack of understanding about schizophrenia, mm-hmm. that specific story becomes a universal story that everyone can relate to, even if they haven't experienced those particular instances of difficulty. So I think my hope is that readers will walk away with something that they can actually connect to and maybe inspire them to also tell their stories.
So because there's a lot in here that's personal, what do you get out of it? I mean, you mentioned wanting to tell the story for a long time, finally getting it between the covers of a book.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, is it a catharsis at all?
It's certainly, there's certainly an element of that. Yeah, I would say so. I think, you know, there were so many things that I had to kind of wrestle with about whether I put them in or whether I left them out. And I thought I really couldn't explain the stigma and the horror of some of the things we went through without showing some deeply intense scenes, and that I wanted, you know, it never helped me growing up that people did not share their stories.
Yeah.
The secrecy around schizophrenia and mental illness and what it's like if someone's treatment resistant and their schizophrenia is really almost like Alzheimer's. It's damaged their brain so much that they can't function.
Yeah.
And there's all these stories that we hear, and I'm glad that there's more stories that are about resilience and about recovery. But I knew I needed to hear the story about the family that doesn't get back together, the family
yeah.
that doesn't, that you're left kind of, at the end, you're just left trying to cope with this enormous illness and tragedy that came through these people.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's, as I said in the instructions, it's often harrowing. I mean,
right.
there's scenes in the book, and you can talk about as much as you want without giving it away for people listening to us.
Right.
There are things in the book that are difficult to read.
Right.
There's violence. But at the same time, I mean, that's your story, and that's who you
mm-hmm.
are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've obviously demonstrated that there is a path out.
Those were the events that shaped me, certainly. And I couldn't really say what the formula is for resilience. There are certainly times when I think, do I wish I'd lived a different story? Yes, I do. Do I wish that my mother hadn't been ill, that my parents had had a joyful, loving marriage? And it's all those what ifs that I think, like, who would I be if I hadn't lived through those things? And how much did this shape my perspective? And how much did it shape my personality? And I think those scenes, I mean, they were, my concern was I didn't want to spread trauma and spread because we can have this vicarious sort of secondary trauma that, you know, years ago nobody even talked mm-hmm. about this kind of stuff. And I didn't want to upset people, so I hoped that the humor would sort of balance off the harrowing parts.
Yeah.
And
it does.
Good.
The scenes in the book that are also very funny.
Great.
And your reaction to some of the less than pleasant parts are surprising, because that's not how I would react.
Right.
But I guess, you know, you've always used humor to help, I guess, to get through it all, right?
Yes, I consider it, I've often called humor my superpower, and I use it as a shield, and I use it as a weapon. And
yeah.
I think it's the great equalizer. You know, in Italy, people speak all these different dialects, and that's why you have Commedia dell'arte, this very physical, broad
yeah.
humor from there. But I think it is the one thing that, when you have those experiences that have sort of flattened you, even pancaked you, at some point, you're just left with so little. And if you can sort of crawl out of that dark place and maybe find some humor, and I'm not saying it's that these things should be humorous, I'm just saying this is how I made it through, and
yeah.
I think a lot of people do.
And it is, as a reader, it helps one cope with
right.
having to read something, you know, terribly unpleasant, right?
Right, right.
When people ask you what sort of childhood it's like, I guess now you can just give them this book and say, yeah,
yes.
read it, right?
Yeah.
But what would you tell them if they asked you heretofore?
I would still tell them it was difficult, and that the ramifications of that childhood live with me every day. They're not in the past. They affect my present. You know, my mother still has severe psychosis, and no medication has helped. And, you know, we live separately, all three of us, and
mm-hmm.
I live in hiding from her. So I think I would just say, like, I wouldn't wish this childhood on anyone. But I have a good life. I've met wonderful people. I've met incredible helpers. I've met people that are doing the work to help sort of the most vulnerable in our community. And I think that has been a huge honor and a privilege to have that opportunity.
Let's talk about your mother for just a sec. At what point in her life, because we see early on, you know, mm-hmm. things aren't what they should be in terms of her behavior and the sort. How long was it until she was, say, diagnosed, and you all knew that there was a term for this?
So she was diagnosed when I was about 14 years old, so she would have been 34 at that time.
Yeah.
But in some of the research that I did, my father, they had an arranged marriage, and my father thought on his wedding night, he thought there's something quite odd about this person, there's something off about her. And I met someone who knew my mother as a child who said to me, you know, there was something always a little bit unusual about your mother when they were about 7, 8 years old. So, you know, my understanding is that her parents married her off to get her out of the village, to get her away from ruining their reputation somehow as a unstable person. But that my mother's mother had an illness, and my great grandmother had an illness, so this was a hereditary thing that was passed down, and my mother got the brunt of it, and it couldn't have helped her to leave like a small village and then suddenly go to a huge city and to marry someone who was an absolute stranger, even though they were related somehow by blood. So I think really early on she probably had this problem. So by the time she was diagnosed, I think her brain had already sustained enough damage that there was not a lot that medication could have done.
Right, right. The reason I ask that is because you and your father are trying to contend with living with her and the sort, and then you would have people, like relatives, tell you that it's probably your fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that she was fine before she had a kid or before she came to Canada even.
Yes, yeah.
And so, I mean, that's a lot to take in when you're 14 or younger even, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think this is part of the dysfunction that happens in families when someone is severely ill and people want to place blame somewhere instead of actually dealing with the problem. They want to sort of say, it wasn't us, it wasn't this. And especially an illness like schizophrenia that terrified people. You know, they didn't really understand it in Italy. They just kind of they blamed us, and, you know, these are not people that lived in the city in Rome where we could go and find, have a selection of doctors to choose from. We were in the villages, you know, and people would be like, oh, I know someone who can help. And in the end, that might as well have been as useful as sacrificing a goat and reading entrails to me. Like, it didn't do anything for us.
And the way your father reacts to not only that, his lot in life, as well as other things, I mean, I don't know if it's because it's the old country or it's their generation, say. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stock into to fate and karma and
yes.
you know,
the
looking to, you know, other things to explain, you know, this is what God wanted or things like that. And that really does screw with one's mind, doesn't it, in terms you know,
yes.
You have a problem, and then this is not the way you should solve a problem, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's. I think it's sort of classic that Southern Italians have a fatalistic look on the world, and it's sometimes quite humorous. But it's really when you come from generations of poverty and oppression, and you think that you know that everything that happens, and you didn't before my dad left Italy. Like, no one really had that ability to. Change their lives that way, to sort of like go to another country, start fresh. So the idea of destiny, or even my aunt used to say about one of my great uncles, was that he was born under a crooked star. So this idea that it's already written, like what's going to happen to you is going to happen to you. And I felt really frustrated with that take on the world. And then I thought, but there are times in your life when you don't feel like you're never really in control, but those times when you really feel like you're just a pinball and the forces are just kind of everything that's happening to you, it's just you're just trying to stay in the game, and you're not you're not aware of how much maybe agency you have in your own life. Yeah. And I mean, this is particularly hard if you come from people who never believe that people have agency in their lives. Like, everything is predestined, you know, so that's, it does mess with you because it means people don't take action.
Yeah.
And they don't fight oppression and they don't fight injustice. They just kind of go, well, that's how things are, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's everybody's crooked and everybody's dishonest, or and so they just don't they don't look for the good and they don't attempt to alter their own destinies that way.
How much stock do you put in superstition nowadays?
Well, I guess it would depend on the superstition. I run towards black cats and I want them to cross my path. I don't, you know, some of those things, I just don't know the history behind those superstitions. I think a lot of superstition was just really an old way of people trying to say, be careful, the world is a dangerous place, here's things that you should avoid. I mean, some of them are really unusual,
sure.
Right? Like black cats, but that's on my mind because Halloween is coming. But
yeah.
I think, you know, I'm in the Italian culture, there's the superstition of the evil eye, and this is what we contend with still. And I do think, like, when you're incredibly sensitive or people are, like, aware of, like, someone doesn't like them, it does make you feel really uncomfortable. And I think these are really old explanations for things that are before we had psychology and awareness of how people affect each other's lives and have an impact on each other's lives. These were the explanations that people had, you know. They're envious of you and that's caused something bad to happen. And I think people were aware enough to know that if they instilled envy in someone else, that they were really anxious about it or they'd be disturbed by it. But the explanation then became this really non-scientific, like, oh, you know, evil eye, that's why all these things befell you. And
we do look, we're so desperate because life is uncertain as it is,
mm-hmm.
for explanation. And these are the things that I guess have worked for centuries for other people, that,
mm-hmm.
that we just take it upon ourselves, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
As a predictor, say, of what's going to happen in one's life.
Yes, yeah.
You think about, say, medicine, for example. A lot of medicines are not that old compared to,
right.
you know, old wives' tales, for example.
Yes, yeah. Or some of those old remedies that they
yeah.
would have used, you know. I think really we have always been seeking answers and humanity's, like, the different ways that we've come up with those answers. Some of them have caused harm, and some of them have just been these sort of, you find, like, evil eye beliefs in lots of culture, and
uh-huh.
some of them are just these things where people are just like, you know, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
The idea that someone being envious of me could cause me harm, especially if I feel it or I carry it with me or
yeah.
things like that. So I think some of that is just them trying to make sense of things that they couldn't make sense of it. But it's, you know, a little bit like putting leeches on someone when they're sick and draining their blood, when
mm-hmm.
you think, well, actually, that's not going to help anybody.
Right.
But in terms of superstition, do I still read my horoscope? Sure.
Yeah.
Do I...
Like tarot?
I still have my tarot deck.
Yeah.
Do I avoid things that I sort of have this intuition about, which I think is something, that we don't give enough attention to, like our own intuition.
Intuition's good, I think. You know,
yes.
your gut check or whatever, I think that's very helpful, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that sometimes superstition was really someone's intuition saying... this is not
someone
safe.
Else's intuition.
Yeah, or someone saying this is this could be a dangerous situation, and we and they couldn't explain it. They couldn't
yeah.
explain what that gut feeling was, and so they just went, "Let me see. I'll just, you know." And that's, I think, why some people pull out the horoscopes or tarot cards, because they're just like,
yeah.
"Something I'm worried about." They're looking for someone to explain it to them when it's really the information is within.
How old were you when you first went to Italy?
I was 5 years old,
yeah.
and that's where my earliest memories are from. And that's the trip that I write about, I think.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book where on that trip,
mm-hmm.
You notice, your dad notices as well, there's a change in your mother.
Yeah.
And a good change, right?
She's very happy, yeah. She was really thrilled there.
That trip and subsequent trips that you made yourself, did that feel? I mean, I guess it feels like home because you're around family, I guess. But
right,
does it feel like at home at all?
You know, when the second time I went, I was 11, and everybody referred to me as La Americana, so it didn't feel like home. People sort of singled me out, and, you know, there was a great sort of disparity between the wealth of the people that had immigrated and the people that stayed behind.
Right.
So that tension was in play all the time, and even though I spoke with that accent, I was definitely treated like, better than a stranger, an absolute foreigner would have been treated, but
yeah.
I was still like a little bit of an outcast because I'd left. I hadn't lived in that place. I hadn't endured what they'd endured. So
there's a great quote in the book. I guess you're talking about your grandmother, but I guess it speaks to being in another place, especially that it softened an ache in my heart and healed a rift in my regular world.
Right. Yeah.
I guess wherever one goes, one looks for that, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, they do. They do.
And so you found that there.
I did with my my paternal grandmother, who I'm named after.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what you lose when you leave a country, and then everyone's operating from a place of loss, and especially if you're the first generation born on foreign soil. There's all these things that are in you that are sort of ancestral wisdom passed down, or all these elements of things that are sort of codes of behavior that you then start to chafe against because they don't really fit in with, say, let's say, Canadian culture in 1980s. So, but I think when I was around my grandmother, that was the time that I felt like this is the person that I should spend more time with. This person, and we're so in sync and we're so... similar. So I think, you know, you don't know. I think when I was 5, that was the first time that I thought, this is what it could be like if I had this really loving maternal influence in my life. And
mm-hmm.
It was so unusual for me that that was what that ache was, that I sensed it. I sensed that I didn't have that in my life, and how tremendous a gift it was to have that.
There are... wonderful moments in the book that have to do with food.
Right.
And I guess I was going to say that's something, you know, that Italians are known for, but I guess every culture, I mean, we all eat, so I guess it's all part of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for Italians especially, it's particularly, it's almost potent, is it, in explaining a lot of things?
It is, yes. They're very, very defensive about their food, and once you eat food, in Italy, you know why. Like, everything's the freshest ingredients. Everything is cultivated from the soil themselves, and they're regional dishes. They're just phenomenal. They're just delicious. But yeah, I think
it evokes so many memories too. I mean, I talk about a later scene in the just before we started a later scene in the book where you're visiting with other family members, and it's a meal at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So many memories are tied to what you ate.
Yes. Yeah. Probably because so many arguments also happen at the dinner table.
At the dinner table, yeah.
You know, I think we just probably had people arguing about the upcoming election, and we probably had people arguing about all the things, and that always happens at the dinner table. So the kitchen and the dining table, that's just such a vital place, so many memories get anchored there, I think, you know.
Yeah. I guess wasps, if they're having a serious discussion or something like that, like to sit around, you know, a living room. But I guess for everyone else, it's around, around mealtime, isn't it?
It is, you know. And pass the food, and also I disagree with you, right? Pass the dish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When was it that because your parents eventually divorce, but they're Catholic, and that's not really something that happens.
It doesn't happen at all.
No. Yeah. And so when does divorce first become, say, an option for them?
Well, you know, I mean, people were telling my dad to consider divorce right around the time that my mom's diagnosis came about. And when she was diagnosed, schizophrenia was the only option, I think, that people had. And then in the subsequent years, I can look and read other information and think, well, actually, there's some schizoaffective elements here. There's also some borderline personality disorder. There's all kinds of stuff that we didn't have the vocabulary for when she was first diagnosed. But early on, a psychiatrist said to my father, like, this could be a very difficult life you could divorce and choose to send her back to Italy, and it'll be better for her, better for you, better for your daughter. And my dad just couldn't, he couldn't face that choice. And he also, by then we had been to Italy, and my mom's dad had suggested an honor killing, and had just sort of said, find a needle, get her put down, let make this problem go away. And I think my dad just was so horrified that anybody could be so uneducated and heartless towards one of their own family members that he just couldn't, he couldn't deal with it. So then I think when I was 20 and I left home to go to university, that was the first time that he went, I can't handle this life, because the buffer was gone. I left, and that cushion that made his life bearable.
Cushion or punching bag.
Yes, know, exactly.
Whatever perspective you want to take.
Yeah.
You mentioned university, and there's a, you talk in the book about applying to different places and wanting, because you grew up in Ontario, wanting to come here to this part of the world.
Yes.
Because you had to get away.
I had to get as far away as possible.
And you couldn't really, because, I mean, there are phones. And
yes.
And at that time, your dad gets sick as well.
Right.
Right? And, and you all don't know what that is.
Yeah.
There's actually a humorous moment where your mother says, you know, he's the crazy one.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She really rode that train as long as she could.
And so you're brought back, obviously, and you have to sort through it. And I guess that is that roughly when the split happens?
No, that was, so that's when he left briefly for a while then, and I came back just long enough to say, I can't deal with any of this, I can't fix this problem. You know, I was telling my dad to get divorced from the time I was about 9 or 10, I just couldn't understand. Yeah. Like, I could, you know, I didn't know what it was like in other people's homes, but I, and television isn't an example, but I could see that people didn't live like this.
Right.
I could see that people didn't live with this level of violence, this level of yelling, this level of absolute misery day in, day out. And, you know, we started having situations with social workers getting involved, or sometimes the police. And so in my early 20s, he thought about it, but then he went back. He just couldn't face the idea of losing the house that he'd worked so hard to earn.
Yeah.
So it took another 16 years. They were married 36 years.
Yeah.
So I remember... when he finally left the house, he left in an ambulance. And then he said to me in the ambulance, I prayed to God and told him if he just let me survive this, I would never go back to that house, that I was willing to let go of all of that. And, you know, it was really fascinating for me because he was 66. And I thought, what a huge lesson that you are never too old to change your life.
Yeah.
But he had to be willing to lose all everything that he'd worked for, and that just was an unfortunate bargain to have to make.
Yeah.
You know, he lost the house, he lost financial security. He'd worked so hard, and he'd been such a good and generous man that I felt angry for a long time that we fell through the cracks as a family that needed an incredible amount of support.
That's the other thing I was thinking about as I was reading the book is do you think the system at all failed you and your parents?
Yes. Yeah, I do, and I think that the system is still broken. I think that I know there are people that are doing incredibly valuable work in the mental health field, and I really appreciate it. It's not something I could have gone into. My mom has a wonderful case manager, and these are people that have too many files on their desks. There's not enough money put into this.
Yeah.
I don't understand why we don't take better care of people. I think... You know, if I was to say to you, like, oh, there's a 87-year-old man with Alzheimer's wandering around the street in winter, at the dead of winter, and he's got no shoes, like, should we look after this person? Of course. We'd go get them, put them in housing. You see these homeless people that are really struggling with florid psychosis, and there's no place for them to go.
Yeah.
Or some of the places might be dangerous. And I think the whole idea that you have to be considered a danger to someone before you can actually get help is absolutely appalling to me. And the result of how many people lose, you know, they lose so much, and they lose their dignity. And this isn't something that we should allow. So I think, you know, we definitely fell through the cracks, but I think the onus, when a family member has a severe illness is usually just on the family, and they take the burden of it. And I feel like that's not how it should be, and yeah. that's not how it should be for any situation, that we should be banding together, that communities should be stronger, and we should be looking after our most vulnerable, and we'll make stronger communities because of it.
You ask yourself this a lot in the book, you know, you're in great because you're out here, and there's obviously stuff yeah. happening at home, and
yeah.
you go back there, and it's impossible to deal with.
Yeah.
There's a scene in the book where you take your mother to a clinic or something like that, and it's just, you know, it's an mm-hmm. experience that you know, you find it, you know, difficult to just navigate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Having to deal with those feelings, having to you know, because people talk, right? People
yes.
say things, and
yes.
so
yeah.
how do you get around that?
I don't think, you know, the entire time I was growing up, people would say to me, well, you know, but she's still your mother.
Mm.
And I just would think, I'm just clearly not getting through to them about how difficult this experience is and how draining it is to deal with someone whose brain is so broken that you can't rationalize at all. And I still have to tell my dad, like, he's thinking like a rational person when he's saying that my mom does it on purpose. Mm. She's not capable of making decisions, and she doesn't, like, there are people who have no agency, and I would count my mother mm-hmm. in that group. There is nothing that anyone could say to me that would be worse than anything I've said to myself in terms of my mother. So it's really wonderful to have this opportunity to have this book out, because Mona Fertig and Mother Tongue Publishing is just wonderful, does wonderful work and taking the risk, and I'm so grateful to her. But in terms of my relationship with my mother, it will always be a failure.
Mm-hmm.
I will die with that relationship having been a failure. And I haven't been able to look after her. I haven't been able to step in and change the course of her life. I haven't affected her destiny for the better. And those are things that will always upset me. But no one can say anything to me like that I haven't said to myself. So I know people will, I mean, back in the village, I made it back there in 2016, so mm-hmm. it had been 36 years, because I just thought, I don't want to see these people. I don't want to see the people that tried to explain away my mother's illness and difficulty as if it was our fault. And I went, and my aunt and my cousin kept saying to me, you know, she was really capricious. And, you know, I was doing the translation, and I thought, that can't be what they're saying. And then I called my dad and I said, what does this word capriccioso mean?
Yeah.
And he said, it's capricious. I mean, he didn't know the word in English, but I figured it out. And then the next time it came up, I said, capricious doesn't end up in jail for shoplifting, and doesn't end up in jail for assaulting people, and doesn't end up with a restraining order, and doesn't lose somebody a house. So perhaps I don't know the word capricious in Italian, but I'll tell you what it is in English, and it's none of the things that we experienced. And I'm really tired of this family acting like it was she was just a little bit more difficult.
Sure.
She was impossible, and she needed support and care, and the first place she should have got it from was her family, the family that she was born into.
Yeah.
And she didn't. And you passed on the problem, and then you acted as if we were the problem, and that's insulting at the very base level. It's something I will not accept. They, at some point I said, you were all very lucky that you don't live in the same village as her. They didn't want her to come back. You know,
yeah.
They didn't want to deal with her.
And so when you did go, I mean, is it a place that you can go back to still?
I'm hoping to go back next year, because I met my father's cousin, who I must have met when I was 11 and I didn't remember.
Yeah.
And the eerie thing, because my parents are second cousins, is that my father's cousin looks a lot like my mother and even has the same mannerisms and gestures.
Uh-huh.
But she's an incredibly kind and generous woman who never sits down, because she's constantly feeding people.
Yeah.
She prepared this meal of lasagna and all the sort of fixings of an Italian family. And I told her, you know, I usually don't eat this well at home. I probably just eat French fries. The next thing I know, there was a plate of French fries put in front of me. And I was like, I think the lasagna will do it. And I just couldn't believe how much, like, if I would mention something, like a dish that I'd had when I was 11, she would run into the village and get it before I even noticed that she had, like, left the room.
Yeah.
You know, because she had a big family. And I thought that was incredibly moving to be a part of that, and to also think, it was hard not to be around her and think, what if my mother had been well.
That's obviously something that was missing from your life that you are seeking now. Mm-hmm. But throughout your life, because you talk about, you know, not just your parents in the book, you're talking about, you know, work and other people that you meet along the way.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to fill that gap, I guess.
Yes, I'm trying to fill that mom-shaped hole in my heart.
Does writing fill any of that at all?
You know, I think writing is just something that it's a powerful passion that distracts me, and it allows me to, instead of sobbing over what happened, I spend my time focusing on sentence structure and story structure.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think I've finally stopped trying to fill that hole. Although, you know, on any given day, you might find me someplace like at Bulk Barn in the candy aisle, and I'm like, just this many sour keys and this much chocolate and this many gummy bears, and this should do me for the night.
Yeah.
So there's just those things that you return back to that are sort of the default things that you think, this will comfort me, but it really won't once your stomach gets involved. But I think the writing is just a way to help me grapple with the things that I want to be able to talk about, and I want us to be able to, like, blow open the world of what it's like when you're dealing with a really difficult situation, and not just keep it in secrecy and shame and in the shadows. I want to be able to, like, say to somebody, this is what it's really like. Now you, let's talk about the mental health system and what needs to be in place, what supports need to be in place. Because if you just want to hear the stories of, like, it was bad for a little bit of time and then everything got better, we found the right meds and it all snapped into place, that's not everybody's story. And I think the value of writing and the value of books is we want to know people's stories. We want to connect to our human family. And the only way we can is if we know what happened to other people in our family.
There's a love of language, this yearning for words, as you describe it in the early part of the book. I mean, that happened early on, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so storytelling was a big part of the family life, wasn't it?
It was, in terms of, there's sort of an oral tradition in Southern Italian culture, because they didn't have the opportunities for education. So they're very entertaining in the way they tell the story. And I think my father in particular is really great at telling stories. So I think I got that from him, even though he's quite certain that it's some kind of gift I was handed at birth from God. So he doesn't think he's got that storytelling ability.
Does he understand how much work it is?
I don't think he does, but I think the funniest thing that happened was after the Toronto book launch, a couple days later, because initially he was, I was running around, and he would sort of say to me, these people don't have water. And then I would come back and he'd say, they still don't have water. And I just at some point said, look around. Hey, this isn't our house and I'm a little bit busy tonight.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, he said to me, like, well, you know, you should have had this. Or you should have. He was concerned with the dutiful daughter being the perfect host.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he started flipping through the book and he said to me, like, this is, and he, you know, people ask me if he's going to read it. And it's difficult for him to read in English, but he still does, and he's jumping around in it. But he said to me, I think this book shows that I was 100% right and that you 100% agree with me. And I said, that's not what it says at all. Really, like, that's your interpretation, and that's not what it says.
So you all live separate lives, but it he's still making the case as to what he did and you know, trying to for other people, I guess, to show that, you know, he was right.
Yeah, so he, you know, about, there's been so many instances, but probably a week before the book launch, my mother tried to break into my aunt's house again, my dad's sister, the eldest sister's house. And so they ended up, my father took my aunt to the police station, and my aunt used to have a restraining order, but those things expire, which I think is really odd.
Yeah.
And so they went to the police station, and my dad translated for my aunt to say, you know, my ex-wife. They typed in my mother's name, and of course, there's this long record.
Yeah.
And the police officer said, you know, well, we'll go talk to her, we'll scold her. But my dad said, you know, this was such a bad marriage and such a bad situation. My daughter wrote a book about it. You want to see it? And the officer says, okay. So he goes to his car, gets it out of the glove compartment, brings it back. And he says to me, you know, the officer, she was, read your first sentence. And she say, oh, my God. And I thought that was hilarious. And, you know, but then, you know, I laughed and then I cried.
Yeah.
Because I thought, you know, this is the thing. Like, it's an amazing gift to be able to have this book. But the reality of the situation is my mother's still ill and she'll still try, you know, she'll still try to break into my aunt's house. She'll search for me. She's not able to understand, like, what's happened. So I think my dad is saying to people, like, that he should be a movie star now. And that he thinks the book is some kind of vindication.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, no, it's just me trying to tell a story and say, you know, I still am on the other side of it. I'm like, I still can't believe some of these things that happened. I still can't figure out.
And
how it went that way.
And your one story, your one family, who happens to have a book out this fall.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, think of all the other families that you know, that can't give a police officer an explanation in the form of a book,
exactly.
right?
Exactly, yeah.
Who should play your dad in the film?
I would love it if Robert De Niro played my dad. But I think this is another story of something that happened just a few months ago. He said he goes to the library and he reads this magazine called Oggi, which is like Hello for Italy.
Yeah.
And he called me one night and said, you know, Lady Gaga, she has Italian ancestry. And I was like, I don't know what's happening. You know who Lady Gaga is? And he says, of course. You think your father, you know, I read, I understand things. And I said, but 30 years ago, I had read something that Robert De Niro came from Molise, Campobasso, our area. And so I'd said to my dad, you know, I heard Robert De Niro is Molisan. He's from Campobasso. And he says, well, yeah, De Niro is a very popular name from our part of Italy. And then, like, a beat, and he says, who's Robert De Niro? And I thought, of course, right? He didn't go to movies when he was married. He was just raising his family, working hard.
Right.
And then, so now I think, wouldn't it be great if it was Robert De Niro? You know?
Who'd play you?
Oh, gosh. Somebody who's funny and goofy. So there's like a whole selection of people to choose from.
Yeah.
Someone who doesn't take themselves too seriously.
Not taking yourself seriously, I think you have to do that, especially when you're writing a book like this, don't
yes.
you?
Yes, yeah, you do. I don't think, like, I'm not walking around thinking this is the most important thing ever. I just, it was a real milestone for me to be able to have this experience. And it's been a real... It's something I'll always treasure, the opportunity that Mona provided and that Mother Tongue Publishing provided. It's not a small thing to be able to make order from chaos and to be able to tell a story that you've been trying for years to tell.
The reaction from you, you've talked about the reaction from your father, but what about other family relations? And I mean, what have most of them read the book, say?
No, and I don't think they will. First, I'm the only bookworm in the family.
Yeah.
I think my dad said to me, you know, I had some relatives come out that were like third cousins and second cousins, and they came to the event and they were hugely supportive, but I think the inner core family, like first cousins, all those, they lived it and they don't want to discuss it. And I think the hardest thing with memoir is you're capturing people at not their best moments. And we would all love to turn back and go, what I know now and how I could change, you know, what I did or how I reacted. And so I did my best to show all of us as flawed, me, my dad, and my mom. And then I wanted to be as kind as possible to the other characters in the story, because I didn't think it was fair to judge them by this situation where no one knew what to do, you know. And neither did, none of us did, but I think my dad and I lived with it day in and day out, and you start to get sort of acclimatized to it, and you just kind of cope as best you can. But some of the scenes are where you're not coping as best you can, and you have to just kind of survive it.
Yeah. I guess if I was a family member, I'd be curious as to how, say, you know, what part I played in it, or how
right.
I'm depicted, even.
Right.
And I'm surprised that the family members who aren't.
Yeah, there. I think, you know, my mother was cut out of my father's family about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And so they've just kept their distance, and I understand why. But in the ensuing kind of years, I have too. So I've felt like I've just kind of drifted away from the family. But when I came here, that was a part of that, was I started actively making friendships and getting to know people that would sort of be the new family, the family that I needed to be an adult in, and not the family that I grew up in and that considered me the youngest, or considered me spoiled because I was the only child, or considered me spoiled because I was a girl. So I needed to form a new family, and that's been an incredible experience.
So you spent, what, 20 years out here?
Yeah, like that. 22 years, yeah.
Does it still feel like home?
It does. I did get a little bit confused on the SkyTrain today when I was coming out here, but I texted a friend of mine on my way here that she used to live, I think, at 12th or 13th in Fraser, and I remember going to her place, and just really heartwarming times, and what a gift it was to meet the people that I met here, you know, to have those connections.
Yeah, the city's changed a great deal, and I always ask people, you know, especially who've lived here a long time and who are now away or who come back, their observations of it, because I live here and I don't notice,
right.
you know, little things that happen, but I guess the thing, you know, the place has changed a great deal, right?
It has. I think, you know, like this happened to Toronto too in the time that I was away. It's just so much busier.
Yeah.
There's so much more traffic, foot traffic.
Sure, yeah.
And in one way, that's really exciting. In another way, I just want to know that at the municipal, provincial, and national level, the government is considering how vital it is that these cities are affordable for people, that it's not just about a living wage, but being able to afford housing, how important that is for a healthy city.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I've just noticed a lot of construction, a lot of buildings, but I want to know that there's...
Who's going to live there, right?
Yeah, yeah. I want to know that the investment is also made in the communities, that people can have co-op housing and they can have affordable places to live. So, yeah, that's...
You've launched the book in Toronto. You're here in Vancouver to launch this book. Mm-hmm. By the time this comes out, unfortunately, that's passed.
Mm-hmm.
You've already heard from some readers, I'm assuming.
Yes.
What do you tell people, especially who haven't read the book, who are looking for, say, a happy ending? I'm sitting talking to you now, and I can tell, you know, you're at peace with certain parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the happy ending that people look for is probably something else.
Yes.
That you probably don't want even.
I wish the story had a happy ending, but the reality is, you know, one of the difficulties I had was choosing an end point because the story is ongoing.
Right.
You know, my mother's still ill. She's still wandering around the city of Toronto. She has a home, but she's still out there looking and actively angry. And she's sort of a person who's frequently in contact with the police, frequently in contact with healthcare workers. And so... I would want a different story for her. I wouldn't want anyone to suffer the way she's suffering.
And the better story for her doesn't necessarily have to involve you, obviously, right?
Right.
Because, I mean, I think that's a lot of people listening just might think, you know, that all three of you live happily ever after.
Yes.
But that's impossible, right?
Yeah, I don't think it was in the cards. I don't think it was ever in the cards when these two got together. And I think... you know, I think my dad says this, where he says, like, I think all the time, like, I hope she's okay. You know, I wish things didn't turn out this way. He says, I just imagine that I couldn't have had you if I didn't have that. And I think he tries to do this kind of, like, weird mathematics.
Mm.
But I think what I would tell people is, like, I mean, do we only want to read stories where everything works out? Do we only want to read stories where there's a tidy resolution? And that's not...
That's not anybody's life, is it?
That's not anybody's life, yeah.
So it's a better life for him today?
It's a much better life, yeah. He's very happy.
And he's obviously proud of the book, right?
Yes, he is. Yes. He's actually, he's giving it away to people. I've sort of said to him, like, you know, maybe you can, like, say to people it's just $22.
Yeah.
And he said to me, well, what's $20 going to, what difference is that going to make in your life? How many coffees can you get for that? And I thought, oh, my God. So, it's been really interesting because he's like, he's meeting people and he's saying, you want to know what I went through?
Yeah.
You're going to have to read this book. And I thought, that's entertaining.
It's convenient, too.
It's convenient, yes. Yeah.
Well, did this take 6 years to write? I mean, it took a lifetime, I guess, to write.
Say it took a lifetime. I mean, I've written different versions of this story. And I used to do a one-woman play. So I've certain scenes were always the ones that were going to stay with me. But I don't want to scare anyone off from memoir by saying it took a lifetime. It took a long time to figure out, you know, I'd spent a lot of time in therapy and I spent a lot of time talking about my trauma and I might've desensitized myself to it. And then it took, this really wonderful person, Mona Fertig, asking for a book about my dad for it to start to kind of fall into place for me. And I realized what I wanted to do was talk about the things that I was uncomfortable about. I wasn't uncomfortable talking about the violence or the schizophrenia anymore.
Yeah.
And I know I didn't want to make anyone uncomfortable with that, but I was uncomfortable talking about the superstition. So that's why suddenly I was like, oh, I see. Here's the layer that I want to add is how frequently we turn to these unusual methods of coping when you're in crisis.
Your bio mentions that you're a former stand-up comic.
Right.
Why does one leave that profession?
Well, when I did it, I signed up with this really wonderful group called Stand Up for Mental Health, run by David Grenier, and he's still running it.
Right.
And I went into it because I was experiencing severe depression and anxiety and probably PTSD without knowing it and without a diagnosis. And I was so sad. And I really appreciate a good laugh.
Mm.
I really appreciate being able to laugh and how what that does to the human body and how it sort of alleviates so much tension.
Yeah.
So I went into it thinking I just need to be able to laugh again. And even if I'm not able to do it and other people will make me laugh, that's what I wanted. So I took classes and then we started performing. And we did it. I was part of that group for about 2 years, I think. And I did a little bit on my own, but I'm not a night owl. I'm a morning person.
Yeah.
So if there's a stand-up that I could do in the morning. But I also felt that it was something I also did to try to, sharpen my prose.
Yeah.
So it's something that was just like one of those things that I wanted to make sure I challenged myself to do.
Yeah.
And then I think once I checked off that challenge, I was like, okay, I think we've gone far enough into your discomfort zone. So let's pull back and see how you can use this as a writer.
I ask that because there's, you know, a lot of talk about the how that field of entertainment is changing.
Right.
And the role of women, how that's evolved or devolved in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was just wondering what your experience was in that as a woman especially.
Right. Well, because I was with this group and we were always performing as a group, I felt like I was part of a really tight-knit family, and we performed in hospitals, we performed in care facilities, and we performed on Granville Island, we did a big fundraiser, and it was just the opportunity to make people laugh about something that you have felt deep shame about.
Yeah.
It can't be. It's so vital, and it's so it's an equalizer.
Makes it easier to write about too, I guess.
It really
end, right?
does. Yeah. Yeah, it really does. Because to carry that bundle around, that sort of that baggage around, it's not helping you and it's not helping anyone. It's not helping communities. But if we can sort of unburden ourselves a little bit and connect. And I mean, this is a problem I'm seeing right now in the world is like, everybody has some sort of struggle, and we shouldn't be comparing our struggles. We should just be sort of acknowledging there's a struggle, and where can we help each other? And where my dad's sort of thing about this is, in life, one day you're going to need the help. So you show up and help people every time you can and every day you can, because one day you're going to need someone to show up for you. And this is what's important. And I think that's what I really got out of the stand-up when I was doing it. So I just needed to be able to laugh, and it gave me that. But it wasn't something that I couldn't have been a serious contender. I think I was just really just wanted to be able to, like, exercise that part of myself that was really wanting to laugh a lot more.
It must be terrifying, especially if you have anxiety and the sort to have to do that.
It was certainly intimidating, and you know, and sometimes you felt like, oh gosh, I thought that joke was really funny, but nobody's laughing, know. And so there's always that kind of tension around something like that. But it was a incredible opportunity to be able to practice telling things that normally would have this kind of intensity in a sort of dark way, but to try to make them, like, hilarious and try to make them light and connect with other people about their difficult experiences. It was an incredible experience.
This has been a delightful experience for me to talk to you again, to meet you this time.
Thank you. It's been absolutely wonderful for me. I really appreciate it.
And it's a beautiful book. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Thanks again for having me.
You're very welcome. The website from her, euphemiafantetti.com. The book is called My Father, Fortune Tellers and Me. It's from Mother Tongue Publishing. It's author Euphemia Fantetti. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.